had tried to be brave, but she had died screaming like all the rest. There were no brave people on that march, only scared and hungry ones. Most were women and children. The few men were very old or very young. The rest had been chained to that gibbet and left for the wolves and the crows. Gendry was only spared because he admitted to forging the horned helm himself. Smiths, even apprentice smiths, were too valuable to kill. They were being taken to serve Lord Tywin Lannister at Harrenhal, the Mount Olam.
You're traitors and rebels, so thank your gods that Lord Tywin's given you this chance. It's more than you'd get from the outlaws. Obey, serve, and live.
It's not just, it's not,
she heard one wizened old woman complain to another when they had bedded down for the night.
We never did no treason. The others come in and took what they wanted, same as this bunch. Lord Beric did us no hurt, though, her friend whispered. And that red priest with him, he paid for all they took.
Paid? He took two of my chickens and gave me a piece of paper with a mark on it. Can I eat a bit of raggy old paper, I ask you? Will it give me eggs?
She looked about to see that no guards were near and spat three times.
There's for the Tullys, and there's for the Lannisters, and there's for the Starks.
It's a sin and a shame, an old man hissed. When the old king was still alive, he'd not have stood for this.
King Robert? Arya asked, forgetting herself.
King Ares, guards grace him, the old man said, too loudly.
A guard came sauntering over to shut them up. The old man lost both his teeth, and there was no more talk that night. Besides his captives, Sir Gregor was bringing back a dozen pigs, a cage of chickens, a scrawny milk cow, and nine wagons of salt fish. The mountain and his men had horses, but their captives were all afoot, and those too weak to keep up were killed out of hand, along with anyone foolish enough to flee. The guards took women off into the bushes at night, and most seemed to expect it, and went along meekly enough. One girl, prettier than the others, was made to go with four or five different men every night, until finally she hit one with a rock. Sir Gregor made everyone watch while he took off her head with a sweep of his massive two-handed greatsword. Leave the body for the wolves, he commanded when the deed was done, handing the sword to his squire to be cleaned. Arya glanced sidelong at Needle, sheathed at the hip of a black-bearded, balding man-at-arms called Polliver. It's good that they took it away, she thought. Otherwise, she would have tried to stab Sir Gregor, and he would have cut her right in half, and the wolves would eat her too. Polliver was not so bad as some of the others, even though he'd stolen Needle. The night she was caught, the Lannister men had been nameless strangers, with faces as alike as their nasal helms. But she had come to know them all. You had to know who was lazy and who was cruel, who was smart and who was stupid. You had to learn that even though the one they call Shitmouth had the foulest tongue she'd ever heard, he'd give you an extra piece of bread if you asked, while jolly old Chiswick and soft-spoken Ref would just give you the back of their hand. Arya watched and listened and polished her hates the way Gendry had once polished his horned helm. Dunson wore those bull's horns now, and she hated him for it. She hated Polliver for Needle, and she hated old Chiswick, who thought he was funny. And Raff the Sweetling, who'd driven his spear through Lummy's throat, she hated even more. She hated Sir Aemery Lorch for Yoren, and she hated Sir Meron Trant for Sirio. The Hound for killing the butcher's boy, Micah. And Sir Ilion, and Prince Joffrey, and the Queen, for the sake of her father, and Fat Tom, and Desmond and the rest, and even for Lady, Sansa's wolf. The Tickler was almost too scary to hate. At times she could almost forget he was still with them. When he was not asking questions, he was just another soldier, quieter than most, with a face like a thousand other men. Every night Arya would say their names.
Sir Gregor, she'd whisper to her stone pillow. Dunson. Polliver, Chiswick, Ref the Sweetling, the Tickler and the Hound,
Sir Aimery, Sir Ilion, Sir Merin, King Joffrey, Queen Cersei. Back in Winterfell, Arya had prayed with her mother in the Sept and with her father in the Guardswood, but there were no guards on the road to Harrenhal, and her names were the only prayer she cared to remember. Every day they marched, and every night she said her names, until finally the trees thinned and gave way to a patchwork landscape of rolling hills, meandering streams, and sunlit fields, where the husks of burnt holdfasts thrust up black as rotten teeth. It was another long day's march before they glimpsed the towers of Harrenhal in the distance, hard beside the blue waters of the lake. It would be better once they got to Harrenhal, the captives told each other, but Arya was not so certain. She remembered old Nan's stories of the castle built on fear. Harren the Black had mixed human blood in the mortar, Nan used to say, dropping her voice so the children would need to lean close to hear. But Aegon's dragons had roasted Harren and all his sons within their great walls of stone. Arya chewed her lip as she walked along on her feet, grown hard with callous. It would not be much longer, she told herself. Those towers could not be more than a few miles off. Yet they walked all that day and most of the next, before at last they reached the fringes of Lord Tywin's army, encamped west of the castle amidst the scorched remains of a town. Harrenhal was deceptive from afar because it was so huge. Its colossal curtain walls rose beside the lake, sheer and sudden as mountain cliffs, while atop their battlements the rows of wood and iron scorpions looked as small as the bugs for which they were named. The stink of the Lannister host reached Arya well before she could make out the devices on the banners that sprouted along the lake shore atop the pavilions of the Westermen. From the smell, Arya could tell that Lord Tywin had been here for some time. The latrines that ringed the encampment were overflowing and swarming with flies, and she saw a faint greenish fuzz on many of the sharpened stakes that protected the perimeters. Harrenhal's gatehouse, itself as large as Winterfell's great keep, was as scarred as it was massive, its stones fissured and discolored. From outside, only the tops of five immense towers could be seen beyond the walls. The shortest of them was half again as tall as the highest tower in Winterfell. But they did not soar the way a proper tower did. Arya thought they looked like some old man's gnarled, knuckly fingers groping after a passing cloud. She remembered Nan telling how the stone had melted and flowed like candle wax down the steps and into the windows, glowing a sullen, searing red as it sought out Harren where he hid. Arya could believe every word. Each tower was more grotesque and misshapen than the last, lumpy and runnelled and cracked. "I don't want to go there," Hot Pie squeaked as Harrenhal opened its gates to them. "There's ghosts in there!" Chiswick heard him, but for once he only smiled. "Baker, boy, is your choice. Come join the ghosts or be one." Hot Pie went in with the rest of them. In the echoing stone and timber bathhouse, the captives were stripped and made to scrub and scrape themselves raw in tubs of scalding hot water. Two fierce old women supervised the process, discussing them as bluntly as if they were newly acquired donkeys. When Arya's turn came round, Goodwife Amabel clucked in dismay at the sight of her feet, while Goodwife Hera felt the callus on her fingers that long hours of practice with needle had earned her.
"Got those churning butter, I'll wager," she said. "Some farmer's whelp, are you? Well, never you mind, girl. You'll have a chance to win a higher place in this world if you work hard. If you won't work hard, you'll be beaten. And what do they call you?"
Arya dare not say her true name. But Arya was no good either. It was a boy's name, and they could see she was no boy. "Weasel," she said, naming the first girl she could think of. "Lommy call me Weasel."
"I can see why," sniffed Goodwife Amabel.
That air is a fright, and a nest for lice as well. We'll have it off, and then you're for the kitchens.
I'd soon attend the horses. Aria liked horses, and maybe if she was in the stable, she'd be able to steal one and escape. Goodwife Hera slapped her so hard that her swollen lip broke open all over again.
And keep that tongue to yourself, or you'll get worse. No one asked your views.
The blood in her mouth had a salty metal tang to it. Aria dropped her gaze and said nothing. If I still had Needle, she wouldn't dare hit me, she thought sullenly.
Lord Tywin and his knights have grooms and squires to tend their horses. They don't need the likes of you,
Goodwife Amabel said.
The kitchens are snug and clean, and there's always a warm fire to sleep by and plenty to eat. You might have done well there, but I can see you're not a clever girl. However, I believe we should give this one to Wheeze.
If you think so, Amabel.
They gave her a shift of grey, rough-spun wool and a pair of ill-fitting shoes and sent her off. Wheeze was understeward for the Wailing Tower, a squat man with a fleshy carbuncle of a nose and a nest of angry red boils near one corner of his plump lips. Arya was one of six sent to him. He looked them all over with a gimlet eye.
The Lannisters are generous to those who serve them well, an honour none of your sort deserve. But in war, a man makes do with what's to hand. Work hard and mind your place, and might be one day you'll rise as high as me. If you think to presume on his lordship's kindness, though, you'll find me waiting after my lord has gone, you see.
He strutted up and down before them, telling them how they must never look the highborn in the eye, nor speak until spoken to, nor get in his lordship's way.
My nose never lies, he boasted. I can smell defiance. I can smell pride. I can smell disobedience. I catch a whiff of any such stinks. You'll answer for it. When I sniff you, all I want to smell is fear.
Daenerys. On the walls of Kaas, men beat gongs to herald her coming, while others blew curious horns that encircled their bodies like great bronze snakes. A column of camelry emerged from the city as her honor guards. The riders wore scaled copper armor and snouted helms with copper tusks and long black silk plumes and sat high on the saddles inlaid with rubies and garnets. Their camels were dressed in blankets of 100 different hues.
Quoth is the greatest city that ever was or ever will be,
Pyat Pri had told her back amongst the bones of Vaes Taloro.
It is the center of the world, the gate between north and south, the bridge between east and west, ancient beyond memory of man, and so magnificent that Sethas the Wise put out his eyes after gazing upon Quoth for the first time, because he knew that all he saw thereafter should look squalid and ugly by comparison.
Danny took the warlock's words well salted. But the magnificence of the great city was not to be denied. Three thick walls encircled Kaath, elaborately carved. The outer was red sandstone, 30 feet high, and decorated with animals. Snakes slithering, kites flying, fish swimming, intermingled with wolves of the red waste and striped zorses and monstrous elephants. The middle wall, 40 feet high, was grey granite, alive with scenes of war, the clash of sword and shield and spear, arrows in flight, heroes at battle and babes being butchered, pyres of the dead. The innermost wall was 50 feet of black marble with carvings that made Danny blush until she told herself that she was being a fool. She was no maid. If she could look on the grey wall scenes of slaughter, why should she avert her eyes from the sight of men and women giving pleasure to one another? The outer gates were banded with copper, the middle with iron, the innermost were studded with golden eyes. All opened at Danny's approach. As she rode her silver into the city, small children rushed out to scatter flowers in her path. They wore golden sandals and bright paint. No more. All the colors that had been missing from Vase Tolloro had found their way to Karth. Buildings crowded about her, fantastical as a fever dream, in shades of rose, violet, and umber. She passed under a bronze arch fashioned in the likeness of two snakes mating, their scales delicate flakes of jade, obsidian, and lapis lazuli. Slim towers stood taller than any Danny had ever seen, and elaborate fountains filled every square, wrought in the shape of griffins and dragons and manacores. The Carthen lined the streets and watched from delicate balconies that looked too frail to support their weight. They were tall, pale folk in linen and samite and tiger fur, everyone a lord or lady to her eyes. The women wore gowns that left one breast bare, while the men favored beaded silk skirts. Danny felt shabby and barbaric as she rode past them in her lion-skin robe with black drogon on one shoulder. Her Dothraki called the Carthen milkmen for their paleness, and Khal Drogo had dreamed of the day when he might sack the great cities of the East. She glanced at her blood riders, their dark, almond-shaped eyes, giving no hint of their thoughts. "Is it only the plunder they see?" she wondered. "How savage we must seem to these Carthen." Pyat Pri conducted her little Khalasar down the center of a great arcade where the city's ancient heroes stood thrice life-size on columns of white and green marble. They passed through a bazaar in a cavernous building whose latticework ceiling was home to 1,000 gaily colored birds. Trees and flowers bloomed on the terrace walls above the stalls, while below it seemed as if everything the gods had put into the world was for sale. Her silver shied as the merchant prince Zara Zoan Daxus rode up to her. The horses could not abide the close presence of camels she had found.
"If you see here anything you would desire, O most beautiful of women, you have only to speak, and it is yours,"
Zaro called down from his ornate horn saddle.
"Karth itself is hers. She has no need of baubles." Blue-lipped Pyat Pri sang out from her other side. "It shall be as I promised, Khaleesi. Come with me to the House of the Undying, and you shall drink of truth and wisdom."
"Why should she need your palace of dust when I can give her sunlight and sweet water and silks to sleep in?"
Zaro said to the warlock.
"The 13 shall set a crown of black jade and fire opals upon her lovely head."
"The only palace I desire is the Red Castle at King's Landing, my Lord Pyat." Danny was wary of the warlock. The Magi, Mira Mazdur, had soured her on those who played at sorcery. "And if the great at Karth would give me gifts, Zaro, let them give me ships and swords to win back what is rightfully mine." Pyat's blue lips curled upward in a gracious smile.
"It shall be as you command, Khaleesi."
He moved away, swaying with his camel's motion, his long beaded robes trailing behind.
"The young queen is wise beyond her years,"
Zaro Zoan Daxus murmured down at her from his high saddle.
"There is a saying in Karth, a warlock's house is built of bones and lies."
"Then why do men lower their voices when they speak of the warlocks of Karth? All across the East, their power and wisdom are revered."
"Once they were mighty," Zaro agreed, "but now they are as ludicrous as those feeble old soldiers who boast of their prowess long after strength and skill have left them. They read their crumbling scrolls, drink shade of the evening until their lips turn blue and hint of dread powers, but they are hollow husks compared to those who went before." Piet Pri's gifts will turn to dust in your hands, I warn you.
He gave his camel a lick of his whip and sped away. The crow calls the raven black, muttered Sir Jorah in the common tongue of Westeros. The exile knight rode at her right hand as ever. For the entrance into Carth, he had put away his Dothraki garb and donned again the plate and mail and wool of the Seven Kingdoms half a world away.
You would do well to avoid both those men, Your Grace.
Those men will help me to my crown, she said. Zara has vast wealth, and Piet Pri pretends to power, the knight said brusquely. On his dark green surcoat, the bear of House Mormont stood on its hind legs, black and fierce. Jorah looked no less ferocious as he scowled at the crowd that filled the bazaar.
I would not linger here long, my queen. I mislike the very smell of this place.
Danny smiled. Perhaps it's the camels you're smelling. The Carthine themselves seem sweet enough to my nose.
Sweet smells are sometimes used to cover foul ones.
My great bear, Danny thought. I am his queen, but I will always be his cub as well, and he will always guard me. It made her feel safe, but sad as well. She wished she could love him better than she did. Zarozo and Daxus had offered Danny the hospitality of his home while she was in the city. She had expected something grand. She had not expected a palace larger than many a market town. It makes Magister Illyria's manse in Pentos look like a swineherd's hovel, she thought. Zaro swore that his home could comfortably house all her people and their horses besides. Indeed, it swallowed them. An entire wing was given over to her. She would have her own gardens, a marble bathing pool, a scrying tower, and warlock's maze. Slaves would tend her every need. In her private chambers, the floors were green marble, the walls draped with colourful silk hangings that shimmered with every breath of air. You are too generous, she told Zarozo and Daxus.
For the mother of dragons, no gift is too great.
Zaro was a languid, elegant man with a bald head and a great beak of a nose, crusted with rubies, opals, and flakes of jade.
On the morrow you shall feast upon peacock and lark's tongue and hear music worthy of the most beautiful of women. The 13 will come to do you homage, and all the great of Carth.
All the great of Carth will come to see my dragons, Danny thought. Yet she thanked Zaro for his kindness before she sent him on his way. Piet Pri took his leave as well, vowing to petition the Undying Ones for an audience.
An honor rare as summer snows.
Before he left, he kissed her bare feet with his pale blue lips and pressed on her a gift, a jar of ointment that he swore would let her see the spirits of the air. Last of the three seekers to depart was Quaithe, the Shadowbinder. From her, Danny received only a warning.
Beware,
the woman in the red lacquer mask said. Of whom?
Of all. They shall come day and night to see the wonder that has been born again into the world, and when they see, they shall lust, for dragons are fire made flesh, and fire is power.
When Quaithe too was gone, Sir Jorah said,
She speaks truly, my queen, though I like her no more than the others.
I do not understand her. Piet and Zaro had showered Danny with promises from the moment they first glimpsed her dragons, declaring themselves her loyal servants in all things. But from Quaithe she had gotten only the rare cryptic word, and it disturbed her that she had never seen the woman's face. Remember Miramar's door, she told herself. Remember treachery. She turned to her blood riders. We will keep our own watch so long as we are here. See that no one enters this wing of the palace without my leave, and take care that the dragons are always well guarded.
It shall be done, Khaleesi,
Aegor said.
We have seen only the parts of Carth that Piet Pri wished us to see, she went on.
Rakaro, go forth and look on the rest, and tell me what you find. Take good men with you,
and women to go places where men are forbidden.
As you say, I do, blood of my blood, said Ricardo.
Sir Jorah, find the docks and see what manner of ships lay at anchor. It's been half a year since I heard tidings from the Seven Kingdoms. Perhaps the gods will have blown some good captain here from Westeros with a ship to carry us home. The knight frowned.
That would be no kindness. The usurper will kill you, sure as sunrise.
Mormon hooked his thumbs through his sword belt.
My place is here, at your side.
Jogo can guard me as well. You have more languages than my blood riders, and the Dothraki mistrust the sea and those who sail her. Only you can serve me in this. Go among the ships and speak to the crews. Learn where they are from and where they are bound, and what manner of men command them. Reluctantly, the exile nodded.
As you say, my queen.
When all the men had gone, her handmaids stripped off the travel-stained silk she wore, and Danny padded out to where the marble pool sat in the shade of a portico. The water was deliciously cool, and the pool was stocked with tiny golden fish that nibbled curiously at her skin and made her giggle. It felt good to close her eyes and float, knowing she could rest as long as she liked. She wondered whether Aegon's Red Keep had a pool like this, and fragrant gardens full of lavender and mint.
It must, surely. Viserys always said that the Seven Kingdoms were more beautiful than any other place in the world.
The thought of home disquieted her. If her sun and stars had lived, he would have led his Khalasar across the poison water and swept away her enemies. But his strength had left the world. Her blood riders remained, sworn to her for life and skilled in slaughter, but only in the ways of horse lords. The Dothraki sacked cities and plundered kingdoms. They did not rule them. Danny had no wish to reduce King's Landing to a blackened ruin full of unquiet ghosts. She had supped enough on tears.
I want to make my kingdom beautiful, to fill it with fat men and pretty maids and laughing children. I want my people to smile when they see me ride by, the way Viserys said they smiled for my father.
But before she could do that, she must conquer. The usurper will kill you, sure as sunrise, Mormont had said. Robert had slain her gallant brother Rhaegar, and one of his creatures had crossed the Dothraki Sea to poison her and her unborn son. They said Robert Baratheon was strong as a bull and fearless in battle, a man who loved nothing better than war. And with him stood the great lords her brother had named the Usurper's Dogs, cold-eyed Eddard Stark with his frozen heart, and the Golden Lannisters, father and son, so rich, so powerful, so treacherous. How could she hope to overthrow such men? When Khal Drogo had lived, men trembled and made him gifts to stay his wrath. If they did not, he took their cities, wealth and wives, and all. But his Khalasar had been vast, while hers was meager. Her people had followed her across the Red Waste as she chased her comet, and would follow her across the poison water too. But they would not be enough. Even her dragons might not be enough. Viserys had believed that the realm would rise for its rightful king. But Viserys had been a fool, and fools believe in foolish things. Her doubts made her shiver. Suddenly the water felt cold to her, and the little fish prickling at her skin annoying. Danny stood and climbed from the pool. Iri, she called. Jiqui. As the handmaids toweled her dry and wrapped her in a sand-silk robe, Danny's thoughts went to the three who had sought her out in the City of Bones.
The Bleeding Star has led me to Karth for a purpose. Here I will find what I need, if I have the strength to take what is offered and the wisdom to avoid the traps and snares. If the gods mean for me to conquer, they will provide. They will send me a sign. And if not...
It was near evenfall, and Danny was feeding her dragons when Iri stepped through the silken curtains to tell her that Ser Jorah had returned from the docks, and not alone. "Send him in, with whomever he has brought," she said, curious. When they entered, she was seated on a mound of cushions, her dragons all about her. The man he brought with him wore a cloak of green and yellow feathers and had skin as black as polished jet.
"Your Grace," the knight said, "I bring you Kahuro Mo, a captain of the Cinnamon Wind out of Tall Trees Town."
The black man knelt.
"I am greatly honored, my queen," he said,
not in the tongue of the Summer Isles, which Danny did not know, but in the liquid Valerian of the Nine Free Cities. "The honor's mine, Kahuro Mo," said Danny in the same language. "Have you come from the Summer Isles?"
"That is so, Your Grace, but before not half a year passed, we call it Old Town. From there, I bring you a wondrous gift."
"A gift?"
"A gift of news. Dragon Mother Stormborn, I tell you true, Robert Baratheon is dead."
Outside her walls, dusk was settling over Carth, but a sun had risen in Danny's heart.
"Dead?" she repeated.
In her lap, Black Drogon hissed, and pale smoke rose before her face like a veil.
"You are certain the usurper is dead?" "So it is said in Old Town, and Dorne, and Lys, and all the other ports where we have called."
"He sent me poison wine, yet I live, and he is gone." "What was the manner of his death?" On her shoulder, pale Viserion flapped wings the color of cream, stirring the air.
"Torn by a monstrous boar whilst hunting in his Kingswood, or so I hear in Old Town. Others say his queen betrayed him, or his brother, or Lord Stark, who was his hand. Yet all the tales agree in this. King Robert is a dead and in his grave."
Danny had never looked upon the usurper's face, yet seldom a day had passed when she had not thought of him. His great shadow had lain across her since the hour of her birth, when she came forth amidst blood and storm into a world where she no longer had a place. And now this ebony stranger had lifted that shadow.
"The boy sits the Iron Throne now," Ser Jorah said.
"King Joffrey reigns," Kahuro Mo agreed. "But the Lannisters rule, eh? Robert's brothers have fled King's Landing. The talk is they mean to claim the crown. And the hand has fallen. Lord Stark, who was King Robert's friend, he has been seized for treason."
"Ned Stark, a traitor?"
Ser Jorah snorted.
"Not bloody likely. The long summer will come again before that one would besmirch his precious honor."
"What honor could he have?" Danny said. "He was a traitor to his true king, as were these Lannisters." It pleased her to hear that the usurper's dogs were fighting amongst themselves, though she was unsurprised. The same thing happened when her Drogo died, and his great Khalasar tore itself to pieces. "My brother is dead as well, Viserys, who was the true king," she told the Summer Islander. "Khal Drogo, my lord husband, killed him with a crown of molten gold." Would her brother have been any wiser had he known that the vengeance he had prayed for was so close at hand?
"Then I agree for you, Dragon Mother, and for bleeding Westeros, bereft of its rightful king."
Beneath Danny's gentle fingers, Green Rhaegal stared at the stranger with eyes of molten gold. When his mouth opened, his teeth gleamed like black needles. "When does your ship return to Westeros, Captain?"
"Not for a year or more, I fear. From here, the Cinnamon Wind sails east to make the Trader's Circle round the Jade Sea."
"I see," said Danny, disappointed. "I wish you fair winds and good trading, then. You have brought me a precious gift."
"I have been amply repaid, the Great Queen."
She puzzled at that. "How so?" His eyes gleamed.
"I have seen dragons."
Danny laughed. "And we'll see more of them one day, I hope. Come to me in King's Landing when I am on my father's throne, and you shall have a great reward." The summer islander promised he would do so, and kissed her lightly on the fingers as he took his leave. Jiqui showed him out, while Sir Jorah Mormont remained.
"Khaleesi," the knight said when they were alone, "I should not speak so freely of your plans if I were you. This man will spread the tale wherever he goes now."
"Let him," she said. "Let the whole world know my purpose. The usurper is dead. What does it matter?"
"Not every sailor's tale is true," Sir Jorah cautioned. "And even if Robert be truly dead, his son rules in his place. This changes nothing, truly."
"This changes everything." Dany rose abruptly. Screeching, her dragons uncoiled and spread their wings. Drogon flapped and clawed up to the lintel above the archway. The others skittered across the floor, wingtips scrabbling on the marble. "Before, the Seven Kingdoms were like my Drogo's Khalasar, 100,000 made as one by his strength. Now they fly to pieces, even as the Khalasar did after my Karl lay dead."
"The High Lords have always fought. Tell me who's won, and I'll tell you what it means. Khaleesi, the Seven Kingdoms are not going to fall into your hands like so many ripe peaches. You will need a fleet, gold, armies, alliances."
"All this I know." She took his hands in hers and looked up into his dark, suspicious eyes. "Sometimes he thinks of me as a child he must protect. Sometimes as a woman he would like to bed. But does he ever truly see me as his queen?" "I am not the frightened girl you met in Pentos. I have counted only 15 name days, true. But I am as old as the crones in the Dosh Kaleen and as young as my dragons, Jorah. I have borne a child, burned a Karl, and crossed the Red Waste and the Dothraki Sea. Mine is the blood of the dragon."
"As was your brother's,"
he said stubbornly. "I am not Viserys."
"No," he admitted. "There is more of Rhaegar in you, I think. But even Rhaegar could be slain. Robert proved that on the Trident, with no more than a warhammer. Even dragons can die."
"Dragons die?" She stood on her toes to kiss him lightly on an unshaven cheek. "But so do dragon slayers." Bran. Mira moved in a wary circle, her net dangling loose in her left hand, the slender three-pronged frog spear poised in her right. Summer followed her with his golden eyes, turning, his tail held stiff and tall, watching, watching.
"Yaish!"
the girl shouted, the spear darting out. The wolf slid to his left and leapt before she could draw back the spear. Mira cast her net, the tangles unfolding in the air before her. Summer's leap carried him into it. He dragged it with him as he slammed into her chest and knocked her over backward. Her spear went spinning away. The damp grass cushioned her fall, but the breath went out of her with a whoosh. The wolf crouched atop her. Bran hooted. "You lose." "She wins," her brother Jojen said. "Summer snared." He was right, Bran saw. Thrashing and growling at the net, trying to rip free, Summer was only ensnaring himself worse. Nor could he bite through. "Let him out." Laughing, the reed girl threw her arms around the tangled wolf and rolled them both. Summer gave a piteous whine, his legs kicking against the cords that bound them. Mira knelt, undid a twist, pulled at a corner, tugged deftly here and there, and suddenly the direwolf was bounding free. "Summer, to me!" Bran spread his arms. "Watch," he said, an instant before the wolf bowled into him. He clung with all his strength as the wolf dragged him bumping through the grass. They wrestled and rolled and clung to each other, one snarling and yapping, the other laughing. In the end, it was Bran, sprawled on top, the mud-spattered direwolf under him. "Good wolf," he panted. Summer licked him across the ear. Mira shook her head.
Does he never grow angry?
Not with me. Bran grabbed the wolf by his ears, and Summer snapped at him fiercely, but it was all in play. Sometimes he tears my garb, but he's never drawn blood.
Your blood, you mean? If he'd gotten past my net,
he wouldn't have hurt you. He knows I like you. All of the other lords and knights had departed within a day or two of the harvest feast, but the Reeds had stayed on to become Bran's constant companions. Jojen was so solemn that old Nan called him Little Grandfather, but Mira reminded Bran of his sister, Arya. She wasn't scared to get dirty, and she could run and fight and throw as good as a boy. She was older than Arya, though, almost 16, a woman grown. They were both older than Bran, even though his ninth name day had finally come and gone, but they never treated him like a child. I wish you were our wards instead of the Walders. He began to struggle towards the nearest tree. His dragging and wriggling was unseemly to watch, but when Mira moved to lift him, he said, "No, don't help me." He rolled clumsily and pushed and squirmed backwards, using the strength of his arms, until he was sitting with his back to the trunk of a tall ash. "See, I told you." Summer lay down with his head in Bran's lap. "I never knew anyone who fought with a net before," he told Mira, while he scratched the dire wolf between the ears. "Did your master-at-arms teach you net fighting?"
"My father taught me. We have no knights at Greywater, no master-at-arms, and no maester."
"Who keeps your ravens?" She smiled.
"Ravens can't find Greywater Watch no more than our enemies can."
"Why not?"
"Because it moves," she told him.
Bran had never heard of a moving castle before. He looked at her uncertainly, but he couldn't tell whether she was teasing him or not. "I wish I could see it. Do you think your Lord Father would let me come visit when the war is over?"
"You would be most welcome, my prince, then or now."
"Now?" Bran had spent his whole life at Winterfell. He yearned to see far places. "I could ask Sir Roderick when he returns." The old knight was off east, trying to set to rights the trouble there. Roose Bolton's bastard had started it by seizing Lady Hornwood as she returned from the harvest feast, marrying her that very night, even though he was young enough to be her son. Then Lord Manderly had taken her castle. "To protect the Hornwood holdings from the Boltons," he had written. But Sir Roderick had been almost as angry with him as with the bastard. "Sir Roderick might let me go. Maester Lewin never would." Sitting cross-legged under the weir tree, Jojen Reed regarded him solemnly.
"It would be good if you left Winterfell, Bran."
"It would?"
"Yes, and sooner rather than later." "My brother has the green sight," said Mira. "He dreams things that haven't happened, but sometimes they do."
"There is no sometimes, Mira." A look passed between them. Him sad, her defiant. "Tell me what's going to happen," Bran said.
"I will," said Jojen, "if you tell me about your dreams."
The guards' wood grew quiet. Bran could hear leaves rustling and Hodor's distant splashing from the hot pools. He thought of the golden man and the three-eyed crow, remembered the crunch of bones between his jaws and the coppery taste of blood. "I don't have dreams. Maester Lewin gives me sleeping draughts."
"Do they help?"
"Sometimes." Mira said,
"All of Winterfell knows you wake at night, shouting and sweating, Bran. The women talk of it at the well, and the guards in their hall." "Tell us what frightened you so much," said Jojen.
"I don't want to. Anyway, it's only dreams. Maester Lewin says dreams might mean anything or nothing."
"My brother dreams as other boys do, and those dreams might mean anything," Mira said. "But the green dreams are different."
Jojen's eyes were the colour of moss, and sometimes when he looked at you, he seemed to be seeing something else, like now.
"I dreamed of a winged wolf bound to earth with grey stone chains," he said. "It was a green dream, so I know it was true. A crow was trying to peck through the chains, but the stone was too hard, and his beak could only chip at them.
Did the crow have three eyes? Jojo nodded. Summer raised his head from Bran's lap and gazed at the mudman with his dark golden eyes.
When I was little, I almost died of grey water fever. That was when the crow came to me.
He came to me after I fell, Bran blurted. I was asleep for a long time. He said I had to fly or die, and I woke up, only I was broken, and I couldn't fly after all.
You can if you want to.
Picking up her net, Mira shook out the last tangles and began arranging it in loose folds.
You are the winged wolf, Bran, said Jojen. I wasn't sure when we first came, but now I am. The crow sent us here to break your chains.
Is the crow at Greywater?
No, the crow is in the north.
At the wall? Bran had always wanted to see the wall. His bastard brother John was there now, a man of the night's watch. Beyond the wall, Mira Reed hung the net from her belt.
When Jojen told our Lord Father what he'd dreamed, he sent us to Winterfell.
How would I break the chains, Jojen? Bran asked.
Open your eye.
They are open. Can't you see?
Two are open, Jojen pointed. One, two.
I only have two.
You have three. The crow gave you the third, but you will not open it.
He had a slow, soft way of speaking.
With two eyes, you see my face. With three, you could see my heart. With two, you can see that oak tree there. With three, you could see the acorn the oak grew from, and the stump that it will one day become. With two, you can see no further than your walls. With three, you would gaze south to the summer sea and north beyond the wall.
Summer got to his feet. I don't need to see so far. Bran made a nervous smile. I'm tired of talking about crows. Let's talk about wolves or lizard lions. Have you ever hunted one, Mira? We don't have them here. Mira plucked her frog spear out of the bushes.
They live in the water, in slow streams and deep swamps.
Her brother interrupted.
Did you dream of a lizard lion?
No, said Bran. I told you, I don't want...
Did you dream of a wolf?
He was making Bran angry. I don't have to tell you my dreams. I'm the prince. I'm the Stark in Winterfell.
Was it summer?
You be quiet.
The night of the harvest feast. You dreamed you were summer in the God's Wood, didn't you?
Stop it, Bran shouted. Summer slid toward the weirwood, his white teeth bared. Jojen Reed took no mind.
When I touched Summer, I felt you in him, just as you are in him now.
You couldn't have. I was in bed. I was sleeping.
You were in the God's Wood, all in grey.
It was only a bad dream. Jojen stood.
I felt you. I felt you fall. Is that what scares you? The falling?
The falling, Bran thought. And the golden man, the queen's brother. He scares me too, but mostly the falling. He did not say it, though. How could he? He had not been able to tell Sir Roderick or Maester Lewin, and he could not tell the Reeds either. If he didn't talk about it, maybe he would forget. He had never wanted to remember. It might not even be a true remembering.
Do you fall every night, Bran?
Jojen asked quietly. A low, rumbling growl rose from Summer's throat, and there was no play in it. He stalked forward, all teeth and hot eyes. Mira stepped between the wolf and her brother, spear in hand.
Keep him back, Bran.
Jojen is making him angry. Mira shook out her net.
It's your anger, Bran, her brother said. Your fear.
It isn't. I'm not a wolf. Yet he'd howled with them in the night and tasted blood in his wolf dreams.
Part of you is Summer, and part of Summer is you. You know that, Bran.
Summer rushed forward, but Mira blocked him, jabbing with a three-pronged spear. The wolf twisted aside, circling, stalking. Mira turned to face him.
Call him back, Bran.
Summer? Bran shouted. To me, Summer! He slapped an open palm down on the meat of his thigh. His hand tingled, though his dead leg felt nothing. The direwolf lunged again, and again Mira's spear darted out. Summer dodged, circling back. The bushes rustled, and a lean black shape came padding from behind the weirwood, teeth bared. The scent was strong. His brother had smelled his rage. Bran felt hairs rise on the back of his neck. Mira stood beside her brother, with wolves to either side. Bran, call them off.
I can't.
Jojen, up the tree.
There's no need. Today is not the day I die.
Do it, she screamed, and her brother scrambled up the trunk of the weirwood, using the face for his handholds. The direwolves closed. Mira abandoned spear and net, jumped up, and grabbed the branch above her head. Shaggy's jaw snapped shut beneath her ankle as she swung up and over the limb. Summer sat back on his haunches and howled, while Shaggy Dog worried the net, shaking it in his teeth. Only then did Bran remember that they were not alone. He cupped his hands around his mouth. Hodor, he shouted. Hodor! Hodor! He was badly frightened and somehow ashamed. They won't hurt Hodor, he assured his treed friends. A few moments passed before they heard a tuneless humming. Hodor arrived, half-dressed and mud-spattered from his visit to the hot pools. But Bran had never been so glad to see him. Hodor, help me. Chase off the wolves. Chase them off. Hodor went to it gleefully, waving his arms and stamping his huge feet, shouting, Hodor! Hodor! Running first at one wolf and then the other. Shaggy Dog was the first to flee, slinking back into the foliage with a final snarl. When Summer had enough, he came back to Bran and lay down beside him. No sooner did Mira touch ground than she snatched up her spear and net again. Jojen never took his eyes off Summer.
We will talk again, he promised Bran. It was the wolves, it wasn't me.
He did not understand why they'd gotten so wild.
Maybe Maester Lewin was right to lock them in the guard's wood.
Hodor, he said, bring me to Maester Lewin. The Maester's turret below the rookery was one of Bran's favourite places. Lewin was hopelessly untidy, but his clutter of books and scrolls and bottles was as familiar and comforting to Bran as his bald spot and the flapping sleeves of his loose grey robes. He liked the ravens, too. He found Lewin perched on a high stool, writing. With Sir Roderick gone, all the governance of the castle had fallen on his shoulders.
My prince, he said, when Hodor entered, you're early for lessons today.
The maester spent several hours every afternoon tutoring Bran, Rickon, and the Walder Freys. Hodor, stand still. Bran grasped a wall sconce with both hands and used it to pull himself up and out of the basket. He hung for a moment by his arms until Hodor carried him to a chair.
Mira says her brother has the green sight.
Maester Lewin scratched at the side of his nose with his writing quill.
Does she now?
He nodded. You told me that the children of the forest had the green sight, I remember.
Some claim to have that power. Their wise men were called green seers.
Was it magic?
We'll call it that, for want of a better word, if you must. At heart, it was only a different sort of knowledge.
What was it? Lewin set down his quill.
No one truly knows, Bran. The children are gone from the world, and their wisdom with them. It had to do with the faces in the trees, we think. The first men believed that the green seers could see through the eyes of the weirwoods. That was why they cut down the trees whenever they warred upon the children. Supposedly, the green seers also had power over the beasts of the wood and the birds in the trees. even fish. Does the reed boy claim such powers?
No, I don't think. But he has dreams that come true sometimes, Mira says.
Well, all of us have dreams that come true sometimes. You dreamed of your Lord Father in the crypts before we knew he was dead, remember?
Rickon did too. We dream the same dream.
Call it green sight, if you wish. But remember as well all those tens of thousands of dreams that you and Rickon have dreamed that did not come true. Do you perchance recall what I taught you about the chain collar that every maester wears?
Bran thought for a moment, trying to remember. A maester forges his chain in the citadel of Old Town. It's a chain because you swear to serve, and it's made of different metals because you serve the realm, and the realm has different sorts of people. Every time you learn something, you get another link. Black iron is for ravenry, silver for healing, gold for sums and numbers. I don't remember them all. Lewin slid a finger up under his collar and began to turn it inch by inch. He had a thick neck for a small man, and the chain was tight, but a few pulls had it all the way round.
"This is Valerian steel," he said, when the link of dark grey metal lay against the apple of his throat. "Only one maester in 100 wears such a link. This signifies that I have studied what the Citadel calls the higher mysteries. Magic, for want of a better word. A fascinating pursuit, but of small use, which is why so few maesters trouble themselves with it. All those who study the higher mysteries try their own hand at spells, soon or late. I yielded to the temptation, too. I must confess it. When I was a boy. And what boy does not secretly wish to find hidden powers in himself? I got no more for my efforts than 1,000 boys before me, and 1,000 since. Sad to say, magic does not work.
Sometimes it does, Bran protested. I had that dream, and Rickon did too, and there are mages and warlocks in the East.
There are men who call themselves mages and warlocks, Maester Lewin said. I had a friend at the Citadel who could pull a rose out of your ear, but he was no more magical than I was. Oh, to be sure, there is much we do not understand. The years pass in their hundreds and their thousands. And what does any man see of life but a few summers, a few winters? We look at mountains and call them eternal, and so they seem. But in the course of time, mountains rise and fall, rivers change their courses, stars fall from the sky, and great cities sink beneath the sea. Even gods die, we think. Everything changes. Perhaps magic was once a mighty force in the world, but no longer. What little remains is no more than the wisp of smoke that lingers in the air after a great fire has burned out. And even that is fading. Valyria was the last ember, and Valyria is gone. The dragons are no more. The giants are dead. The children of the forest forgotten, with all their lore. No, my prince. Jojen Reed may have had a dream or two that he believes came true, but he does not have the green sight. No living man has that power.
Bran said as much to Mira Reed when she came to him at dusk, as he sat in his window seat watching the lights flicker to life. I'm sorry for what happened with the wolves. Summer shouldn't have tried to hurt Jojen, but Jojen shouldn't have said all that about my dreams. The crow lied when he said I could fly. And your brother lied too. Or perhaps your maester is wrong. Oh, he isn't. Even my father relied on his counsel.
Your father listened, I have no doubt, but in the end, he decided for himself. Bran, will you let me tell you about a dream Jojen dreamed of you and your fustling brothers?
The Walders aren't my brothers. She paid that no heed. You were sitting at supper, but instead of a servant, Maester Lewin brought you your food. He served